Okay. Nichols versus Southern Illinois University. Mr. Lynn.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is John Lynn, and I represent the four appellants in this case, Derek Nichols, Babatunde Owusini, Dan Smith, and Aaron Watson. The plaintiffs, who are black, are current or former police officers for the defendant university, SIUE. They allege basically three claims in the case. It's a claim of race discrimination, basically, and retaliation for complaining about the race discrimination. And those claims are brought under Title VII. I'd like to briefly discuss each of those three claims and highlight some of the reasons why we think summary judgment was improper, and to show why there are issues of disputed fact, a lot of issues of disputed fact, that show that plaintiffs are entitled to their day in court in this case. The first claim is asserted by all four plaintiffs, and that's the claim that they were assigned more often, in fact, more than twice as often, as the white police officers to the inferior PO1 job on the East St. Louis campus. And there are two main points to make about this claim. First, it's quite clear that Chief Harrison did rely on race in assigning the plaintiffs to the East St. Louis campus, because he admitted that he did. There was this meeting between the plaintiffs and Chief Harrison where essentially the plaintiffs accused him of sending them to the East St. Louis campus at a higher rate than the white officers. And he didn't say, you know, I don't know what you're talking about, I didn't do that. He essentially said, yeah, that's what's happening. And he explained why it was happening. He said that the administration at the East St. Louis campus had requested, quote, more black faces in the police force on that campus. Now, Chief Harrison said the same thing, or essentially the same thing, to three other university officials, including Paul Pitts, who's the EEO officer for the university. He told Mr. Pitts that the administration at East St. Louis wanted, quote, more of a black presence at the campus among the police officers. And he further explained that the administration at the campus wanted more black officers because they wanted the police force to reflect the surrounding community. Now, East St. Louis is a predominantly black community. In fact, it's 98% black.
And what is the, in that regard, Mr. Lynn, is there a larger minority population, student population, not general population, at the East St. Louis campus as opposed to the Edwardsville campus?
There's a big difference. The student body and the faculty and the staff at the East St. Louis campus are predominantly black. And the student body is drawn from the local community. It's actually a little bit different. I mean, it's not really, there aren't any SIU students attending that campus. There's a charter school, a high school, and a Head Start program, and various programs. They draw from the local community, so it's mostly a black situation. Chief Harrison told one of his subordinates, Captain Hayes, that he intended to comply with the administration's requests. And I think this constitutes direct evidence that race was a factor in the job assignments. And the defendant has not explained how they could have achieved more black faces, more of a black presence, without relying on race.
Counsel, for you to prevail on this claim, you have to overcome all the case law in this circuit holding that a lateral transfer of this sort is not a materially adverse employment action.
Well, a lateral transfer can be. It depends on the circumstances. There's no per se rule in that regard. And this court has said, you know, many times that it's a fact question usually. It's a fact-sensitive question, what constitutes an adverse employment decision. And here we have, I think, overwhelming evidence that they were transferred to an inferior job, substantially inferior job. What the evidence shows, and this comes from a lot of the defendant's own witnesses, is that if you were at the Edwardsville campus, you were basically doing the work of a police officer. You were, you know, enforcing traffic laws. You were making arrests. You were investigating crimes. You were a police officer there. At East St. Louis, you did very little of that. You were basically just a security guard. All you did was patrol hallways, you know, check doors, unlock doors, patrol buildings on foot. You know, what didn't involve traffic enforcement, it didn't involve much in the way of crime investigation because the campus is so small. You know, there are only 2,000 students at the East St. Louis campus.
How many officers would be assigned at the main, I guess it is the main campus?
Main campus would be
as opposed to there? Yeah, what's the percentage of need for a number of officers?
Well, at East St. Louis, it ranged from between 4 and 7 officers there.
On a shift or overall?
Squads, I think. Overall, I mean, the total number of officers there would range between 4 and 7.
What about the other main?
Well, there are a total of 22 officers. So whatever that's subtracted from.
Okay. Well. So it's less than 1/3, I guess.
It's you know, a relatively small percentage, but the blacks were being assigned there at a disproportionate rate.
So it's, aside from the fact that race aside, as far as the population of each school, this one is smaller. It doesn't have as many, I guess, extended duties. Apparently, it's
right.
There's no crime there to investigate.
A lot less.
Well, there's 2,000 versus 14,000.
Right, and you have dorms, residence halls at the Edwardsville campus. You know, people live there.
I see. Nobody lives at.
Nobody lives at the East St. Louis campus. You know, in the evenings and weekends, it closes down. You know, it's a ghost town on weekends. You know, and evenings and. So the job duties are completely different, even though the job title is the same. And this court has said, you know, if a transfer or assignment involves significantly diminished material responsibilities, then it can be an adverse employment action. And again, it's an issue of fact for the jury. And what the statistical evidence in this case is powerful because it shows that the white police officers were assigned to the East St. Louis campus during the relevant time frame for which there are statistics only 25% of the time. The black police officers were assigned there 61% of the time.
The statistics don't reflect or take into consideration, however, the preferences of the officers. Some of the plaintiff officers, as I understand the record, asked for East St. Louis.
Well,
on a
did.
More frequent basis, and some white officers did as well, and the statistics don't reflect that reality.
Well, the statistics, I mean, we took that into account. The only police officer who requested assignment to East St. Louis in the PO1 job, I mean, that's the inferior job that we're talking about. You know, and they may have requested other jobs that were superior jobs, but the only officer who requested the PO1, the inferior job, was Officer Watson, and he did it for particular reasons on a temporary basis because he could get academic credit if he went there. He could do an internship there. He couldn't do it at Edwardsville. He could only do it at East St. Louis. So, I mean, he thought the job was inferior, but he was willing to go there for a semester or two in order to, you know, finish out his degree. And plus, he was working a lot on his degree there. He was working on a 100-page handbook that he was getting academic credit for. So he wasn't just doing, you know, this boring, repetitive security guard stuff. But we took into account his request in the statistics. And when you do that, because it's only one request during the relevant time frame, when you do that, the percentages only change by 2%. So he still got, you know, it doesn't make a material change in the statistics. So he still got a situation where the black officers are assigned to East St. Louis at more than twice the rate of the white officers. And there is no credible explanation from the defendant why that was happening, except the obvious explanation. Chief Harrison wanted more black faces there because the administration in East St. Louis had asked him for more black faces. At least, at a minimum, that's an issue for the jury to decide.
Now, is it your position also, or standing alone, Mr. Lynn, that the assignment to the East St. Louis area in some way limited potential advancement because the experience gained there as an officer would be just less than the Edwardsville experience?
And the plaintiffs did testify to that in their depositions. You know, they felt that way, and it was a reasonable concern because, you know, if you don't use your skills, you tend to lose them. And
it's just a tour of duty that doesn't point toward advancement as quickly as a tour at Edwardsville.
You're not acquiring the skill. You're not doing the work of a police officer. You're not learning how to be a better police officer in East St. Louis. You're just learning how to be a better security guard. And if you're somebody like Plaintiff Owasini, he was assigned to East St. Louis 80% of the time. Now, if you're doing 80% of your time is doing security guard work, then, you know, that impacts on your career growth. So it's not just simply the inferior duties. There is this additional aspect that you mentioned.
Were these four the only black officers on the force?
That's correct. And there were no blacks in any command position, which means, you know, sergeant or above.
Now, these administrators who requested, as you put it, what, more black faces, did they say, or something like that? I assume they're all black, too.
You know, the record doesn't show that, but that's a fair assumption, given...
I think you said earlier that... They were both, the students were, you say predominantly, and mostly, probably everybody, and the same with the teachers and administrators, I guess.
Well, I said faculty and staff, but the actual administrators, the people on top, you're right, I would assume that they are black.
Yeah, well, I don't know what their psychology is of that, but I suppose it just, I don't know why they would do it, but the fact is they did. I guess.
Well, they did, but and I don't, you know,
That isn't a good reason, I guess.
No, you know,
nevertheless,
nice,
they did it. And
it would be
I
nice.
I guess that there are certain things you're put in a position. I don't know why, but that.
Well, it would be nice if the record reflected, you know, why they did that. But you know, the defendant hasn't produced that evidence. I believe I'm out of time. Unless there are any more questions.
Rebuttal, but if you want, so it's your time. If you want to use part of the rebuttal, you may. Otherwise, you want to reserve it.
I'll reserve.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lynn. Mr. Cooper.
A little moving to do here. May it please the court, my name is Ian Cooper and I represent the university. There are three issues raised on appeal. We've only talked about one of them so far. I'll try and address the assignment issue first, the upgrade issue second, and the retaliation claims third. First, let me see if I can address some of the questions that were raised during Mr. Lynn's argument. First of all, Your Honor, Judge Sykes, you asked the question about the case law in the Seventh Circuit relating to lateral transfers. And indeed, throughout the brief, I'm concerned that Mr. Lynn has characterized this as a transfer. It's not a transfer. What is happening here with all of the officers in the university's police department is a rotating assignment. I would suggest that it'd be useful to look at Exhibits 13 and 14, which reflect the nature of the assignments and how they rotated through. for instance, the four plaintiffs in this case moved from back and forth from Edwardsville to the East St. Louis campus, as is reflected in the Exhibit 13 and 14. I think it's also important to bear in mind that a lateral transfer to be actionable must really materially change the nature of the duties and significantly impact the chances for advancement for the persons claiming an adverse employment action. There is not one shred of evidence in the record that assignment, temporary rotating assignment to the East St. Louis campus impacts negatively any officer's opportunity for advancement. It is inappropriate to suggest that there's testimony in this case that it works that way. I think Mr. Lynn said in his argument that it was the plaintiff's perception that their own skills would deteriorate by being assigned, which is curious because the evidence is, in fact, that at least two of these officers requested assignment to the East St. Louis campus. Those are officers Watson and Smith. Watson, it's undisputed. His only claim in this case, by the way, as to the appellant Watson, is as to the assignments. He makes no retaliation claim. He makes no claim of inappropriate upgrades. So the one appellant in this case whose only claim is that he was improperly assigned to East St. Louis admits throughout the record that he, in fact, requested the challenged assignment. As for Officer Smith, he too requested assignment, and opposing counsel is attempting to make a distinction between PO1 and another position. Well, assignment as a police officer to the East St. Louis campus or the Edwardsville campus, whether as an SRO or in any other position, amounts to the same thing. You're being a police officer. They have different populations, smaller at East St. Louis. Edwardsville is a residential campus with students who are obviously living there, and it presents different issues relating to residential life. But you're a police officer, whether you're at East St. Louis or at Edwardsville, and it's demeaning to suggest otherwise. Furthermore, as to Officer Owasini, who was assigned the most of any of the African-American officers to the East St. Louis campus, it is undisputed in the record that he told others in the department that he liked being assigned to a certain sergeant, and that was Sergeant Jacobs. And this is reflected in the affidavit of Captain Tony Bennett. And because of that, because Jacobs was assigned to East St. Louis, Sergeant Jacobs was, Owasini had to go to East St. Louis to work with him.
Is that a permanent assignment?
No.
No, for Jacobs.
And actually, that sergeant would rotate through as well.
The sergeant also rotates.
Yes, Your Honor. And so, but there would be movement back and forth. You want to stay with Jacobs? Well, that's where he is, and that's the point about Owasini.
Well, did Jacobs go there more often than others?
Uh-huh. And he was Caucasian, and Sergeant Jacobs liked working there, as a number of Caucasian officers like to do, and requested assignment there, and were posted to that assignment two semesters and so forth, as many times, for instance, as Officers Watson and Smith.
Well, there seem to be two definitions of these two campuses. East St. Louis is one, it's a crummy place, or it's an easier job. The other is that Edwardsville is bigger and more like police, maybe more challenging, but I also assume it's harder.
Well, I'm having a hard time figuring out which definition is the appellants are trying to use here. If it's a crummy place, I invite you all to come see it. It's brand new, one of the nicest places that the university has, and was opened in 2001 and serves an important population. It is a different place in that it has a smaller population and not a residential population of people who live there on the campus. But there's nothing dangerous. I mean, the cases talk about, you know, if it's a lateral transfer and you're basically, and I think even Judge Murphy cited a case that talked about this, if you're out all of a sudden in an office and then you've been moved to, dig ditches out in the cold, well, that's something different. Every officer on the police department has to serve both places. That's what, when they sign up and become employees of the university, they have to agree to do that. So this is not like a transfer where you're demoted or changed in material respects in terms of your position. You're a police officer, whether you're in East St. Louis or whether you're at Edwardsville. Let me address the upgrade issue. It's undisputed that Officer Watson did not seek an upgrade. As to Smith, Owasini, and Nichols, the appellants who do claim that they were passed over for these upgrades, amazingly in their depositions, they all three admitted, and I cite this in the record, that they had no idea what the qualifications were of Officers Delmore and Royston, who got these so-called long-term temporary upgrades. There's an important distinction that you should understand between an upgrade and a promotion. A promotion is a permanent change in your status that is governed by the state university's civil service system. You have to be placed on a register after you pass a couple of tests, a written portion and an oral portion, and you have to be on the top few of that register in order to qualify for that kind of promotion. None of the African-American officers ever qualified for promotion because none of them passed all the required tests and or were placed on the register. their
neither
claim.
Did the two officers that were upgraded, though.
Exactly, and that's perfectly appropriate.
That's the nature of the temporary.
That's upgrade. The nature of the beast. When there is no register to look to because no one has passed all the pieces of the puzzle, then you have what's called management discretion. The command staff of the police department looks at the needs, the skills of the people involved, and makes a determination. The only thing that the appellant's claim in this case made them more qualified for the upgrades was, quote, seniority. Well, seniority was not a part of the collective bargaining agreement in terms of upgrading temporarily to that position. No management employee, the person who made the decision maker, that is to say Chief Richard Harrison, never said, well, we consider seniority. In their briefs and below, they said, well, others told me that seniority would be a factor, therefore we could assume that seniority effect. Well, the case law is clear that statements of opinion by non-decision makers as to the reasons for making decisions have no impact in a summary judgment context like this. The reason Delmore and Royston got the upgrades is they were more qualified, and that remains unchallenged and essentially undisputed. The third argument I'd like to address relates to retaliation. Again, Officer Watson makes no claim of retaliation. This is limited to officers or former officers Owasini and Smith and Nichols, and then those three gentlemen have different claims because Smith and Owasini went through a civil service merit board process that resulted in their discharge, whereas Nichols did not, and Officer Nichols remains with the force today. This is the key point, and it makes this case, I think, unusual, perhaps, in terms of what you might normally see here in the Seventh Circuit. The Civil Service Merit Board system, in order to discharge an employee, requires that the employer state charges for discharge. Well, why do you believe that this employee should be discharged? And then there is an independent, and it is not challenged on appeal that this is independent. It can't be challenged. There's no evidence in the record that the Merit Board's process relating to Owasini and Smith was anything other than independent. Then the Merit Board has an independent factual review of the record to determine whether or not there were grounds for the decisions that were being suggested by the university. So the real decision maker in this case as to Owasini and Smith and their discharge was the Merit Board. Now, our argument has been throughout, you must show somehow that the Merit Board's decision, let me back up one step. The only claim of an adverse employment action with respect to retaliation asserted by Owasini and Smith is that they were fired. That's it. So we've got to determine in this case whether or not the termination was in fact the result of retaliatory animus. The decision to terminate was made by the Merit Board and only became effective at the time that the Merit Board rendered its decision in September of 2003.
Mr. Cooper,
yes,
as to Officer Smith, is my understanding the Merit Board felt the termination justified because Officer Smith chose to go outside the chain of command. Is that right?
Well, actually, that's not quite right. The Merit Board's findings, which are in Exhibit Q as to Officer Smith, give four reasons. One, recurring gross insubordination and disobedience to management directives, including personal use of the squad car. Secondly, making and spreading false statements concerning fellow officer and chief of police on or about December 30. Improper letter of December 30 to University President Walker. And I'll get to that in a second. And D, failure to reasonably cooperate with police investigation involving a newspaper article. Each one of those separately and independently supported the discharge. And that's critical, I think. But as to the improper letter, the point here is that the letters that were sent by officers Owasini and Smith were not protected conduct. They were filled with lies. I hate to use that word, and I use it very sparingly in my practice, but that is what they were, and that is what the Merit Board found. It is, it is Hornbook law, and certainly it's in cases decided by members of this panel, that frivolous claims, even frivolous claims of race discrimination that would otherwise be protected lose their protection under Title VII. But many of the claims that were made and asserted in the letter had nothing to do with race discrimination. Officer Owasini attacked the chief in seven different ways. He said that he had a relationship with a parking service agent that was improper. He said that he allowed Sergeant Mike Wright to take leave when he shouldn't have. He said that there were numerous other things that had nothing. He said he manipulated civil service test scores, which would be an illegal act under the state of Illinois, none of which has anything to do with claims of race discrimination in assignment or upgrades or anything like that. The language used by the merit board in the findings of fact relating to Owasini are, and this is Exhibit M, I think are critical. The hearing officer found and says the hearing officer believes that the employee made false allegations about his superiors in other offices for the purpose of undermining management's authority. That's what the merit board found.
That decision is appealable to the state trial court.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
And no appeal was taken?
In fact, that's exactly right. If we're correct, which I know we are, that the merit board was the decision maker here as to the termination, then the process provided beyond the merit board stage is to go directly to the circuit court and file what amounts to a de novo review of that decision. That was not done. And I suggest maybe you want to ask opposing counsel as to why that wasn't done. During our argument in the court below, it became apparent to me that the reason that was done was because it was a tactical decision on the part of the plaintiffs to avoid the collateral estoppel effect of a reviewed administrative judgment. Well,
why wouldn't we be bound by those findings of the merit board regardless of whether it's appealed or not?
Well, it's an interesting question. Under the Supreme Court's ruling in University of Tennessee versus Elliott, they held that unreviewed administrative findings don't have a collateral estoppel effect. But here's the key. That doesn't mean they're irrelevant. It doesn't mean you ignore them. What we're saying, Your Honors, is this, simply put. No reasonable jury could find in favor of Smith or Owasini on the retaliation claims. They engaged in conduct that was gross in nature, that violated the tenets of any normal employee, let alone a police officer, who is bound to uphold the trust and integrity of not only the department but of the community that they serve. Police officers have a higher duty in that sense to truthfully report information. And here what they've done is they fired off a completely baseless set of letters to the president of the university with no factual support for many of the statements made in those letters. Officer Nichols is the third person who has a claim, and if I might just briefly finish my thought, one or two sentences about Officer Nichols. He claims that as a result of his being placed on leave, not terminated, but being placed on leave, following an incident that he was involved in where he wrestled a disabled woman to the ground and placed her in handcuffs and put her in a squad car, that was retaliation for his making complaints of race discrimination. The undisputed facts in the case show that management clearly believed, and it's undisputed, that it was appropriate to place a police officer on leave with pay, I might add, during a time when they were investigating his fitness to serve following this excessive force incident. And those facts remain undisputed. If there are no other questions, I want to thank the court for their attention.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Mr. Lynn.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Nichols episode was described in a brief. He did absolutely nothing wrong. And there was absolutely no investigation done by Mr. Cannon before he suspended him and sent him off to do these intrusive and totally unwarranted psychological examinations. And why didn't he investigate it? Why didn't he talk to Officer Nichols? Why didn't he talk to the woman involved? Why didn't he talk to her father? Why didn't he talk to the witness who was a professor at SIU who said Mr. Nichols did absolutely nothing wrong? Why didn't he do any of those things? Because he wasn't interested in knowing the truth. He was interested in getting back at Officer Nichols because he had the temerity to charge Chief Harrison with racial discrimination. The business about the merit board, we didn't even have to have a hearing before the merit board. Under Title VII, it's de novo review. Our only exhaustion requirement is to file a charge with the EEOC. That's it. And if we're going to talk about the merit board findings, we may as well talk about the EEOC findings, because the merit board didn't consider our retaliation claims. They refused to consider them. The EEOC, of course, did. And what did the EEOC find? They found, first of all, there was discrimination with regards to the job assignments, and they found there was retaliation. They found that the complaints that the plaintiffs made were protected conduct. And none of them, they found that those complaints were not knowingly false, that they had a good faith belief in each one of those allegations. And many of the two main allegations were the assignments to East St. Louis, which they have massive evidence to support a good faith belief on that, and the upgrades. There's massive evidence to support they had a good faith belief on the upgrades, because the evidence shows that seniority was supposed to be a factor. In fact, Chief Harrison himself told Darren Cannon at the time, or shortly after the upgrades, that seniority was a factor. Now they're claiming seniority was not a factor. That's not what Chief Harrison said at the time, and that's not what the plaintiffs were told by Sergeant Jacobs, who himself participates in the upgrade decisions.
Mr. Lynn, what is the time frame on this period of assignments, in your view, the inappropriate assignments? Over what time frame?
Well, we have statistics, complete statistics, for the time frame from the summer of 2001, which is when the campus opened, until the through the fall of 2002. So we're talking about 5 semesters.
Now, in regard to that, you had mentioned earlier that the administration at East St. Louis had made this request.
Correct.
And the chief, in making his initial assignments, or over that period that you've just described, did he inform I don't need the specific dates, but did he inform the assigned officers that he was acting in compliance with that request?
No, he did not.
So the officers were unaware of the administration's request. They just were informed of their assigned duties.
Right. What they could see happening was that they were being assigned there on a regular basis.
No. I appreciate their perception, right. And I'm just trying to get a read on it. And when did they first become aware to the extent that they felt a discriminatory effect? In other words, not the initial assignment, because anybody could be assigned for one semester, obviously, or whatever. How deep into this time frame did it appear to the plaintiffs that the conduct was inappropriate?
It was November 2002, so it would have been after about 4 or 5 semesters. You know, it takes a while for a pattern to unfold.
No, I understand.
And that's what happened.
So they sensed it from the pattern, not from the initial assignment by the chief.
From the pattern, that's correct, over a period of time. And I disagree with almost every single thing the counsel said, including the word "the." But everything is in our brief. And so, I guess I'm out of time. But sorry, let me just say one thing. It's absolutely untrue that Officer Owasini accused the chief of manipulating civil service scores. That did not happen. And it's not in his letter to President Walker. And he did not ask Sergeant Jacobs to be assigned to work with Sergeant Jacobs. He emphatically denied that in his deposition and his affidavit. That's at least an issue of fact. And there's no affidavit from the defendant saying, who did he make this request to? I mean, there's no affidavit from the defendant to show who it was. Unless the court has any questions, I guess I've exhausted my time.
I'll cut you off, but your time had expired. Thank you, Mr. Lynn, and thank you, Mr. Cooper. The case is taken under advisement.